Bonjour from Montreal. Today the plan is to continue on with lecture 15, in which we'll be starting chapter 6 of the book, which looks at converter topologies. Chapter 6 has these different sections within it. 6.1 gives a base approach for how to begin manipulating standard subcomponents of power electronics to produce different topologies. Derivation of the basic buck boost, and other circuits that we've been analyzing in the class. As far as lectures, we're going to skip over this section. While useful and interesting to see some sort of a formal derivation of these topologies, it's not really necessary for the purposes that we're working towards. 6.2, we will look at briefly today. There won't be much new here. The utility of this is really just the table listing the basic characteristics of these different converters. It'll be a good reference as we move forward to see kind of conversion ratio and the basic implementation of each of these topologies. 6.3 we'll get to today. Here we're going to start talking about new converter topologies that incorporate a transformer as part of their fundamental operation. So far in the course, we've looked at this DC transformer, which was really just an empirical construct, something that could not be physically realized. We'll start looking as we put real transformers within the circuit. How does that alter its operation? How does that benefit the behavior of the converter? When can we use that effectively? And then 6.4 and 6.5 really begin looking more at 6.4 dominantly, more at how do we compare different topologies and how do we decide which one would be advantageous for a given application, what sorts of characteristics push us towards something like a boost over something like a buck boost. So beginning with 6.2, we have a short list of converters, a very short list because in reality there are an infinite number of converters that can be derived. If we allow an infinite number of inductors, switches, capacitors, we could continue adding more and more, making more and more complex topologies ad nauseum. So what we'll really focus on in this section is two simple classes of converters, both of which are single input, single output. And the first class contains a single inductor. In this class, we can really show the full range of possibilities within the class, and that's going to be 8 different converters that have a single input, single output, and single inductor, and behave as a power electronics converter using pulse width modulation and doing the things that we've looked at so far. Within the single input, single output, but dual inductor, there are more topologies than will be listed in this section of the book. We'll look at several of the more interesting ones, a limited subset of possible single input, single output, two inductor converters. The combination of these two, while not comprehensive, shows most of the common topologies. A high percentage of the total BWM converters out there will be contained within this short review of different converter topologies. Okay. So to kind of classify these different single input, single output, single inductor converters, the book divides them into DC to DC, DC to AC, and AC to DC converters. This distinction is a little bit arbitrary, as any of these could act as a DC to DC converter. Where the distinction is made is the topologies here and here have potentially a bipolar output, which allows them to either operate as a inverter, which could produce an AC positive negative output, or a rectifier, which could take an AC positive negative input and convert it to a monopolar output. The DC to DC converters have a unipolar output, so positive input will yield positive output, or negative in the case of buck boost, but always the same polarity. So they could not be used as purely AC output that goes positive negative. So jumping into 6.2, the book has this table of different topologies. Like I said, this is a useful reference to go through and just quickly see for different topologies what is the conversion ratio, what sort of output voltages are achievable if I plot that conversion ratio over the full range of duty cycles, and what is the base circuit of this topology using ideal switches. So the buck and boost, these ones are fairly familiar at this point. Also, the buck boost and non-inverting buck boost are all things we've seen in the homework. And the buck boost is, of course, inverting, so M of D is less than zero. It's always negative. So we produce a controllable voltage, which is of opposite polarity compared to the input. And then this non-inverting buck boost converter that we've seen in the homework has the kind of same magnitude of the conversion ratio, but non-inverting, so same polarity input and output at the cost of two additional switches. When we get into these bipolar output converters, the bridge we've seen in the homeworks, this is a very common topology used in many inverters today. It's going to consist of four switches. It's called a bridge converter because if I actually sketched out the switch implementation of these two single pole dual throw switches, what I'd get is a full bridge of controlled transistor type switches. It has a conversion ratio that kind of looks like a buck. The difference is that it's shifted so that it can go from minus one to plus one, but still a conversion ratio proportional to the duty cycle directly. The Watkins-Johnson, we show two different implementations, the four-switch implementation, and then the two-switch employing a transformer implementation. Both of these theoretical analysis under ideal conditions would give the same conversion ratio shown here. The last two here, the still bipolar output converters, boosting in this case through a current-fed bridge looks just like the bridge converter, with the caveat that the inductor is moved from this location to the input. This is called a current-fed bridge because applying our volt-second analysis, our cap charge balance, what we'll see is that the power feeding this full bridge made up of the two switches is really in the form of a constant current. Once we get into steady state, this inductor should have a constant current, and now I can model this whole thing as just a constant input current source at a given operating point. And then the inverse of the Watkins-Johnson, where we either switch around the output or switch around the location of the transformer, give us a similar bipolar output converter. But now both these have this asymptote at 0.5. So within two inductor converters, some of the most common are here, the Chuuk and the Sepik. The Chuuk converter we've looked at a little bit, the Sepik we may not have mentioned. Now using two switches, two inductors in both cases, we can get these alternate conversion ratios, the Chuuk being inverting, the Sepik being non-inverting. These two a little bit less common, but potentially of some interest. The inverse of the Sepik, again, just inverting the whole thing, swapping input and output, we get as a new converter, and then the buck squared converter, which is so called because its conversion ratio looks like a buck's conversion ratio, but squared instead of D, we have D squared. Could be useful in the case of a large step down if we wanted a 100 volt input, one volt output with a buck converter. We'd have to have 1% duty cycle, which is very small, hard to regulate. The buck squared, we could have 10% duty cycle, and because of that squaring action, still get the 1 over 100 conversion ratio. So those are our list of some subset of different converter topologies. Now moving on to section 6.3, what we want to get into is adding transformers to these circuits. Okay? And there are a number of reasons why we may do this. One is to provide galvanic isolation. If for safety requirements, we need the input source and the output source to be completely isolated with no direct electrical conductive connections between them. The other main one that's kind of buried in here is using transformer turns ratio. To aid in conversion ratio. The example I just mentioned with the buck squared, if we wanted a 100 to 1 volt converter, still fairly difficult, even a 10% duty cycle. And we'll look at how that results in increased losses operating one of these converters at the extreme ends of the duty cycle and the extreme ends of the conversion ratio. So a nice thing about a lot of these topologies that integrate a transformer is we can use that transformer turns ratio to change the conversion ratio of the converter. So if we wanted a 100 to 1 volt converter, if we can somehow incorporate a 100 to 1 turns ratio transformer, then we can have the transformer doing the bulk of the work and stepping that voltage down, and the converter really just doing the regulation around it. And we'll look into analyzing that in the coming slides, coming lectures. Another one here, as compared to if we want isolation, if we were looking at a line frequency converter, if we wanted to do a rectifier off the 60 hertz line, a 60 hertz transformer is quite large and bulky, for reasons having to do with preventing saturation. If we incorporate a transformer instead within a switching power supply, we can have the fundamental frequency seen by that transformer be the switching frequency, which is potentially much higher than 60 hertz commonly would be. So we can design a 100 kilohertz transformer instead of a 60 hertz transformer, and we'll get significant benefit in terms of the size of that element. This minimization of stresses has to do with altering the conversion ratio, letting the transformer do that work instead of an extreme duty cycle. And then another possible option we won't spend a lot of time on is the possibility to obtain multiple outputs. If we have, instead of a two-turn transformer, a three-turn transformer, we can use that extra turn to power an additional output. And in modern electronics, where we need things like a 12-volt supply, a 5-volt supply, a 3.3, and a 1.2-volt supply, it can significantly benefit the overall size of the power conversion system if we can generate multiple voltages from a single supply. We can do that by having a transformer with multiple outputs, each with a different turns ratio, each altering the conversion ratio in their own way. So what we've looked at so far for a transformer is this ideal transformer model that we derived in order to motivate the mathematical analysis using our DC transformer. And the equations for that, for example, for a three-turn transformer are shown here. If we had just had a two-turn transformer, it would just be kind of this section of these equations with polarities as noted on the left here. This is what we call the ideal transformer model. This is an approximation of transformer behavior that is valid assuming that the transformer is operated under certain conditions and designed in certain ways. The most notable limitation of this model that we discussed a little bit in class is that this can directly apply DC, and there's no problem if I put V1 is equal to some DC voltage, 5 volts, my equations in them don't have anything that tells me that won't work fine. But in fact, applying DC to a transformer will result in issues. And to motivate what these issues are, namely saturation of the transformer, what I want to do is do a quick overview of transformer design and the realization of this element. And we'll get into this a little bit more in the final third of the course when we actually do magnetics design section. Okay. But for now, what I want to look at is realizing a real transformer, how that's done, and what the implications of the design are. Okay. So to make a real transformer, what we need is some closed loop of a magnetic material, and that's what's shown here. And when I say a magnetic material, what I mean is that this is some material with the permeability mu, which is much greater than the permeability of free space, mu naught. And for reference, mu naught is 4 pi times 10 to the minus 7. An example would be different types of ferrite material, which are commonly used in the tens to hundreds of kilohertz range for realizing inductors, transformers, any magnetic component in switch mode power supplies. Okay. So if we take this material in order to realize a transformer, what we need is both the magnetic core material and a number of windings, which are going to be the windings in our ideal model. And those windings are going to be implemented by taking some conductor, usually copper, and winding turns around this magnetic core material. So for example, I could put a primary winding on here, winding kind of like this, coming over the core and then back behind it, completing these turns. And eventually pulling my lead out. This would now be my primary winding with a voltage VP and a current IP and some number of turns. I'll call it NP, even though I've drawn four here, this could be any different number of turns. Okay. Now, as I take this winding and I begin applying current flowing through it, IP, what's going to happen is this winding is going to generate some flux. And that flux is going to flow in a closed loop. It's going to flow according to the right-hand rule. So if I look at this winding and allow my right hand, my fingers to wrap in the directions of the coils, the way my thumb points is the direction that the flux will be going through this winding. So based on me doing that here, the flux is kind of flowing in this direction. And I'll call this flux V sub M, M being for magnetizing. This is the flux within the magnetic material. And as we know from a basic course in EM, any flux must flow in a closed loop. It's kind of the magnetic analog of current in the electrical domain. So this flux is going to be flowing through the coil if the current has coil flowing in it. And the path that this magnetic flux is going to take depends on the characteristics of the materials and the different directions it can go. So it is possible that my flux could kind of flow in a loop here. And I'm going to call this one phi sub L, or probably better is phi sub K, so we don't confuse with the inductance L. The other path that my flux could take is it could kind of stick within the core here and flow around this loop and then complete like this. Okay. Now, depending on how we construct this thing, always both of these two flux loops will be present, but in different magnitudes. And based on the assumption here that the permeability of the core is much, much greater than the permeability of air, it means that this is going to be a lower reluctance or a path that the flux has more incentive to flow in. So this is going to directly tell us that our magnetizing flux, Vm, flowing in the loop through the magnetic material is going to be much greater than the what we call the leakage flux, P sub K, that flows out of the core material and completes in a loop through air, and that this is going to be approximately equal to zero. So we can more or less neglect this V sub K. In reality, it's always there, and we'll talk a little bit later about what results from the presence of that. But at least for a first estimate, we can say this is negligible in magnitude, and more or less all of the flux generated by this winding is going to flow purely through the core material because it's so high permeability. Okay. So this is my first turn. This would be my winding with some power coming into it. If I want to make this into a transformer, I'm going to have to add a second winding that power is going to be coming out of. I'm going to sketch the secondary winding here, and I'm going to have it first go underneath the core and then kind of come up like this. This would be my VS for my secondary. This would be the magnitude of this would be the polarity of my IS, my secondary current. And I sketched it in this way so that my magnitudes would work out as shown here. If I have the right-hand rule on the left side and the flux is kind of going in this clockwise direction, then over here on the right, my flux is going down. So if I make my coil as shown where it curves around the back of the core, then the two the flux will correspond in both of them, and I can draw my polarities the same here as shown. So what I want to do is look at the behavior of this circuit that I've created now. And to do that, I'm going to have to use a couple of Maxwell's equations. We'll use them in a simplified form, making a couple of assumptions. So my assumptions here, One is going to be that the flux flows uniformly through this core. So if I looked at a cross section of the core here, I'll say that this cross section has some area A sub C, area of the core. At every point on this surface that I've just drawn, the same magnitude of flux is passing through it. So the flux is uniformly distributed in the core. Which will simplify as I begin taking integrals and Maxwell's equations, the result of those. My other main assumption, which was stated up here with this top analysis, is going to be that the flux is contained entirely within the core. Okay. And under these two assumptions, I can begin applying my Maxwell's equations. Predominantly, I'm going to work with Faraday's law and Ampere's law. Beginning with Faraday's law, so Faraday's law really tells me that the derivative of the flux flowing through some surface bounded around the outside by a conductor is equal to the voltage on that conductor. So under my assumptions here, I can say that the flux is kind of uniform within any one of these coils. I can take a single turn of that as my conductor, and I can say that the voltage on a single turn is equal to the derivative of this magnetizing flux. It would be equal to the derivative of the total flux flowing through that coil, but based on my second assumption that that flux is just phi m, I'm neglecting phi sub k. Okay. If I now have n turns all in series on, for example, my primary, what that would tell me is that my total primary voltage is equal to the number of turns and times the voltage per turn, and the voltage per turn is on the left here, so I get d phi sub m dt as my total voltage on the primary side. This phi is the flux resulting from some current flowing through this winding, and V is the voltage that I'll see on the terminals of the winding. Okay, and here we've gone far enough to really see why I can't apply DC to this winding. So let's say if VP was some DC voltage, what would result is that I'd get an equation that says VDC, and I'll divide the NP over here, is equal to DPM by DT. So if I kind of plotted this Vm versus time when I apply a DC voltage to the winding, assuming it starts at zero, where it starts, we may not know yet, but assuming it starts here, what I get is some constant slope line, the slope VDC over NP, because I know the derivative of this is equal to VDC over NP. That means in time, eventually this flux is going to go to infinite. What are the implications of that? Well, we may need to see a little bit more about how flux affects the behavior of this circuit. And to do that, I'm going to go a little bit farther by using Ampere's law. But initially, this is something to be concerned about. Very, very rarely do we like infinite values in our circuit operation. So the next slide, we'll look at the implications of that infinite flux. But first, I want to apply one more equation to this, and that's Ampere's law. Okay. And what Ampere's law tells me is that if I defined some closed loop, the integral of the B field flowing through that loop is equal to the current enclosed by that loop. So in one form, I could write that the enclosed current by some contour with some surface in between it is equal to, in this case, 1 over mu, if I want to write this in terms of B field, times the integral around that contour of B dl, around the external edge of that contour. Okay. Well, this B field, hopefully for you're familiar with, but B is just a variable denoting flux density. So B is a flux per area in terms of units. In our case, because we've assumed that the flux is uniformly distributed and entirely within this core, my B is just going to be my total flux divided by the area. And since it's uniform, my B is constant at any point in this core. So for us, this is going to look like phi m total flux divided by AC total area. That'll give me my flux density. Okay. And so in order to evaluate Ampere's law, I needed to find some kind of a contour that I'll be integrating on. And what I'm going to use is this line that I've plotted here as my contour. Okay. This line that goes through kind of anywhere in the center of the core, that's going to have a total current enclosed. If I'm just looking at the primary at this point, I'm ignoring the secondary for the moment. And we'll add in the secondary a little bit later. But the primary current, if I have zero current in the secondary, so let's say that my primary has some current, my secondary is really open. I've got some switch here to open the secondary, ensuring that it has no current flowing in it. Okay. In that case, my current enclosed, I've got IP current in each of these windings, and I've got NP different windings. So my I enclosed is IP times NP. And this will be equal to 1 over mu. Now my flux is constant throughout this whole contour. So if I take the integral, it's just going to be this constant flux density, phi m over AC, times the length. So I need to give this contour some length. I'll call it LM, the length of the magnetic path. Okay. So if I do that, I can evaluate this integral quite simply. It's just going to be a phi m over AC times LM. Okay. So now I have two equations talking about the behavior of this magnetic element, both under the assumption that really the primary is the only winding doing anything at the moment. Okay. And if I take these two equations and combine them, what I can do is solve this equation on the left for phi m and then plug it in the equation on the right. And what I'll get is that using the equation on the right, Vp is equal to Np. Apologize for the lag in my laptop at the moment. Times the derivative of phi m. and phi m I'm going to get by solving this equation on the left for phi m and plug that in. So if I do that, I'd multiply both sides by mu AC and divide by LM. And what I'll get is IP NP mu AC over LM. And just kind of simplifying here, I can combine, within this derivative, the only thing that could possibly be varying with time is IP, the current coming into the primary winding, NP, the number of turns, mu, the permeability of the material, AC and LM, geometrical constraints. We expect that these all are going to remain constant during operation. So I can pull those all out of the derivative, and what I'll get is NP squared mu AC over LM times the derivative of IP. And that's all equal to VP . So what does this tell us? Likely you could have predicted this before I went through any of the analysis, but this equation is telling me that the voltage on this primary winding is proportional to the derivative of its current. So I've got V is equal to something times di dt. And this, by definition, then, is an inductance, right? VL is equal to L di dt. So this thing here is some LM, some inductance, we call it the magnetizing inductance, seen by this winding. Okay. Now, if I add in the secondary winding, what I'd get is that when I do my Ampere's law, I would have the current N times IP contributed by this primary winding, and I'd be subtracting off, because the current is in the opposite direction, NS times IS, all the current from the secondary. So with two windings, the current that actually flows in this equivalent inductance is the difference between the input current times its turns ratio and the output current times its turns ratio. So in our ideal model, we said that zero is equal to that difference, right? So effectively, what the ideal model has said is that we don't have this magnetizing inductance. This LM doesn't exist because there is never any current that could possibly be flowing through it in this equation. The difference that we're going to see when we now look at this real model, where we actually have a finite permeability of the core, is that I've got some third pathway here that is the magnetizing inductance LM. And that's going to have some non-zero current, depending on the waveforms applied to it. If there is any voltage V1, that V1 is going to develop some current IM. And now my equations are still going to work out. What I have is a magnetizing inductor, which is really a non-ideality. And then I have remaining an ideal transformer, and together these constitute a valid model of a real magnetic circuit. These equations are still going to apply. The difference is going to be that I1 is not here, I1 is here. Okay, so the current coming into the ideal transformer is still dictated by this, but if I look at the total current coming in, that's going to be this I1 plus whatever the magnetizing current is. Okay. So at the physical element, there is going to be some difference between the reflected and scaled currents in the primary and secondary. Okay. If I had gone about and included the effects of this leakage flux, what I called phi k, what I get is a more complicated model where I actually have now additional parasitic elements. LK, let's call it LK2, LK1, LK3. So each of these windings would have what we call some leakage inductance, which has a small magnitude, but a magnitude corresponding to the amount of flux which flows out of the core and completes its loop in air without flowing through the other windings, so the non-coupling flux. Okay. So our ideal transformer has LM, which goes to, importantly, not zero. Because this LM is a shunt element across the winding, this actually goes to infinity in the ideal case, which means that as I apply voltage to this winding, it won't develop any current. IV is equal to LDI dt, but if L is infinite, then my DI dt is V over infinity, and it should go to zero. Okay, so the ideal transformer, this magnetizing inductance goes to infinity, which means it'll have an impedance that looks like an open, and it'll fall out of the circuit. And then my LKI, LK1, LK2, LK3, they all go to zero. So they look like there's no inductance there, and they turn into shorts. Okay, but a real transformer, if we ever build one of these, will always have leakage on every winding and magnetizing inductance of the core. What you'll note is that this magnetizing inductance I drew inside of the leakages close to the actual ideal transformer. So I can represent this magnetizing inductance on any one of the windings by reflecting it through as we've done before. So I can push this magnetizing inductance through the transformer turns ratio to get some magnetizing inductance represented, for example, over here on the secondary in parallel with this V2. You can push it anywhere in this transformer in the magnitudal scale, but that it's really a single element that models the magnetization from any winding. Okay. So the other thing we want to look at here is what is the effect of this comment down here that if I apply a DC voltage, my flux will go off to infinity. And to understand that, what we have to look at is the characteristics of any real core material. So any real core material will have this BH curve. B is again this flux density. H we skipped over because of the representation we used in Ampere's law. H is my magnetic field intensity. It's going to have the same relation to MMF that flux density had to flux. B, or my flux density, really depends on the integral of the voltage. That's just coming from this equation here, integrating both sides. I can get my flux from the integral of the voltage, and the flux density is just that flux scaled by the area of the core under our assumptions. Okay. And H is really going to be determined by the magnitude of this IM, the amount of current flowing through that magnetizing inductance. Okay. And then during a kind of normal operation, we'll be in this curve. If I compare the B field and H field within the magnetic material, in this linear field, we can approximate the behavior as B is equal to mu H. From this, mu is a scale factor deciding what this curve looks like between B and H. So the slope of this curve here is proportional to the inductance. It's also equal to mu, the permeability of the core. And to verify, if I look at my equation here, my inductance was NP squared mu AC over LM. So indeed, that inductance is proportional to this permeability. So if this slope is mu, when I go up into this portion of the curve, what we call the saturation portion, mu goes to not quite zero. It'll never go all the way to zero, but it'll actually run down to mu naught. And our assumption here on the behavior of this material is that mu is much greater than mu naught, the permeability of free space. So if I drive too hard, if I continue applying voltage, if I apply a DC voltage, I'll kind of, in my plot, start from here. My flux density, which is just the flux scaled by the area, will begin increasing, and it'll keep doing so, and it'll go up and up and up, and eventually reach this curve where the slope of this BH characteristic changes. And this means that the permeability will drop rather suddenly in a ferrite-type material. From whatever it is, whatever we designed around, to mu naught, the permeability of free space. Effectively, once I get up into this region, if my permeability changes to mu naught, it looks like the core is not even there. In the saturation region, the core, from a magnetic standpoint, really just looks like air. And what's going to happen is my transformer, which was once some nearly ideal transformer with a magnetizing inductance in parallel with it, but that magnetizing inductance was quite large, close enough to infinity for our circuit to operate well, that magnetizing inductance is going to drop very rapidly to some very small inductance, and it's going to look more or less like I've shorted out my primary winding. Instead of all of my current being coupled through the transformer and getting to the secondary, it's all just going to flow through this essentially shorted primary winding. likely it's going to cause issues as far as the current on the primary. But even if not, I'm not going to be able to deliver power across this transformer because that primary winding is shorted out. So there's not going to be this coupling that allows power to be transferred through. So what this does is it limits our operation here. I can't apply any sort of DC voltage. Instead, my voltage always has to be AC. So on this curve, my flux, which is the integral of voltage, will kind of increase, and then I'll get to the peak of my AC, and then it'll decrease back down, and I'll stick in a loop here where my permeability remains more or less constant. So this is an important thing as we start implementing these in power converters, that we need to make sure that these transformers don't saturate. And this is not just a problem if we apply DC to a winding. So I can say that if I apply a VP to a transformer and I apply a purely AC waveform in this voltage, maybe I get the loop that I drew here in this BH curve as I scale everything through these different geometrical characteristics of the core and magnetic characteristics. But if by some accident or some error in my controller, I generate an AC waveform with a little bit of a DC offset, what's going to happen is my BH curve, because my B is the integral of voltage, it's going to, every period, integrate up that small amount of DC that's left, and the flux is going to increase and increase and increase, and it may take hundreds of switching periods before it happens, but eventually my curve is going to shift up, and I'll saturate this magnetic element. The other possibility is we're going to be limited in terms of how much voltage we can apply in an AC waveform. So if I tried to instead apply something like this, if my curve was what I drew here before, then this green one would kind of be this type of a curve, encompassing this whole BH curve, and during part of the interval when I'm up here, I would be saturated. During part of the interval, I would be not saturated. This would be a very difficult converter to control now because the inductance is going to be changing dynamically across a switching period. When it's in this region, my mu will be equal to whatever I designed, and my inductance will be high. When it's up in this region, my mu will drop to mu naught, and my inductance will dynamically decrease significantly. Okay? So as we begin designing converters around these transformers, we really need to make sure that the transformer is reset, is the term that the book uses, to make sure that there is no accumulation of volt seconds that cause this magnetizing inductor current to run away. Now, this was a quick overview of kind of the physics of magnetic materials. And like I said, we'll go into that in a little bit more detail and a little bit more formality later on in the course. Just wanted to motivate this aspect of when we implement a transformer in a power electronics converter, even if we're not trying to use this magnetizing inductance for energy storage, even if it has, we expect almost no current in it, we need to make sure that it doesn't saturate, otherwise the whole thing will fall apart. This concept is very similar to what we've looked at in terms of volt-second balance. If I have some DC offset, if I'm applying a DC voltage to a magnetizing inductor, its current is going to increase, and if I apply DC voltage across the whole period, its current is going to be increasing across the whole period, and I won't have my steady-state operation like we've derived. My current at the beginning and at the end of the period will be radically different, and I won't be in steady state. So similarly, in order to achieve steady state ever in a converter containing a transformer, we're going to need to make sure that we somehow reset this magnetizing inductor current such that eventually we reach a mode of operation where there is zero average voltage applied to our transformer across this magnetizing inductor. Okay. The notes here from the book say we need to reset the transformer volt seconds to zero by the end of the switching period. It doesn't necessarily need to be reset to zero every period, but once we get into steady state, we need to make sure that we're applying zero volt seconds within a steady state period. So we can have the case where we increase the magnetizing inductor current during some transient and it levels out with, say, an amp flowing through it. But from that point on, we neither increase nor decrease the magnetizing current. So it stays steady and we've reached steady state. So what we're going to do is, as we analyze these converters, and many of them, as far as the converter operation, it's sufficient to use the ideal transformer model without a magnetizing inductance. And that'll give us correct equations in terms of conversion ratio and currents throughout the converter. But we need to actually include this magnetizing inductance to make sure that it's going to be reset. Okay? So even if it doesn't really play a significant role in the operation of the converter, it still needs to not saturate. Okay? In order to determine this, we can really just treat the magnetizing inductance as any other inductor and figure out how we can apply volt-sec balance to it to make sure that it reaches some steady state current. So the first set of different converter topologies that we'll look at that incorporate a transformer are buck-derived isolated converters. And we call them buck-derived because they're really just going to operate much like a buck. The only difference is we're going to use this transformer turns ratio to aid in the step up or step down of the voltage. So in the buck converter, we used this single pole dual throw switch to rapidly switch back and forth between positions 1 and 2 and generate a waveform here. Let's call this VS that looked like this, where it was VG during part of the period and 0 during part of the period, and we controlled that with the duty cycle. So what we're going to do with these isolated buck-derived converters is generate basically this same waveform here, where we have some PWM that is either 0 or some voltage. Here I'm going to call it VX as the peak, and 0 here. And we're still going to have this LC filter afterwards that filters out all the switching frequency and above harmonics and gives us a DC output voltage. The difference is going to be how we implement this incorporating a transformer. So this VX, instead of being VG, may now be VG times N. So we use the transformer turns ratio to scale it down. In order to implement this, what we're going to need is 2 circuits here, and there's a number of ways that we can implement each. But the circuit on the left here is going to be a DC to AC, really a inverter. This waveform that I want at the output is some AC waveform plus a DC offset. If I tried to get that directly out of the transformer because of that DC offset, it would saturate immediately. So what I'm going to have to do is generate some kind of a purely AC waveform here. And VP may look like this, may look like this, but somehow I'm going to generate an AC waveform with no DC component that can be then sent through the transformer. It's going to generate a VS, and then what I'm going to have here is switches for really rectification that are going to take this AC waveform and now insert this DC component back into it so that I can now send it down the line, have all of the AC filtered out, and just have the DC remaining. So I'm almost out of time here, but just to give you a taste of the next lecture, the first one we'll look at is the full bridge converter. What we use is a full bridge of transistors to generate an AC waveform that's passed through the transformer and then these diodes. Basically, we'll take a waveform that looks like the second one I drew here, this kind of a shape, and then using the diodes, we'll just flip the negative half of it up. So the diodes will then give me this out of it. This looks just like what I wanted for the buck converter. I can then use an LC filter at the output to cut out all of the AC and just get the DC by controlling the duty cycle of these pulses. I can control the output voltage. But now I'll have this transformer turns ratio in there, allowing me to possibly achieve a very large conversion ratio. Okay, so we'll end there. We'll pick up here on Friday. Thanks, guys.